We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala not to make this our ultimate, you know, wanting and desire, but rather we want our ultimate desire to be Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala instead. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.
The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The warning, this would exacerbate the humanitarian situation in the country, suffering from all kinds of diseases like malnutrition and famine. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will ask, what is this world coming to when the ones that are being bombed are being sanctioned, while the ones doing the bombing and the killing can go scot-free and get a green pass to continue the siege and the killing?
Saudi Arabia and its allies, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015 to oust the Ansarullah movement, which took power following the resignation of the country's former president, Abdul Rabbuh Mansur Hadi. The conflict that has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, has been described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, in defiance of calls to help end the war, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the designation will take place on January 19th, the day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. In a statement, Pompeo accused the movement of terrorist acts, destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The allegations drew backlash from Yemeni officials.
Taking this decision at this time is the result of great local and international political pressure to stop the war in Yemen. And America is the one that does not want to stop this war and this aggression.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council also branded the United States as a source of terrorism and vowed to respond to its designation move. Iran also condemned the U.S. for branding Ansarullah a terrorist entity.
It's likely the bankrupt U.S. government will do further damage to its reputation in its final days and leave the region with an even more poisonous legacy.
Aid groups also blasted the U.S. blacklisting move, with Oxfam calling the decision a counterproductive and dangerous policy that will put innocent lives at risk. The United States, along with some other Western countries, are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has so far turned a deaf ear to calls from international rights groups and politicians inside the U.S. to halt arms sales to the kingdom. Now the ball is in the court of Joe Biden, who will officially take the helm at the White House on January 20th. It remains to be seen whether he will toe the line of his predecessor towards Yemen or change course.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, radio host and political commentator Eli Joseph James, joins us from Chicago. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, Elijah Magnier, if I may. We're looking at this sanction that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced against the Ansarullah movement, and it does consist of three of its leading leaders. Now, Mike Pompeo, months ago, was advised against not doing this, or the Trump administration, but yet it has chosen this time to do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think this day was the day that it, or this time is the time that it, the announcement was made?
Well, the architect of the Saudi war on Yemen is definitely Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy because he has no military experience or training. He lacks government management and a necessary intelligence to acknowledge that this is a useless war and far from being considered as a victory. He rather engaged in multiple human rights violations and crimes against humanity and gave an incentive for the Houthi to develop their deterrence. Now, it is the U.S. State Department who is responsible for the designation of foreign terrorist organizations. So the Crown Prince pushed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his last 8 days, and Pompeo, who visited Riyadh in the last few months, he pushed him to issue a designation against the Houthi, who never attacked Americans, but fought against Al-Qaeda and against the invaders of their countries. And here we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. A foreign terrorist organization designation is definitely a political act. So the Trump administration could have made the technical decision to designate the Houthi any time in the last 4 years during the Trump administration. Now, under Biden administration, removing the designation is not that easy. It's a difficult political and bureaucratic process. Now, branding the Houthis as terrorists would be an attempt to block Biden and the world from speaking to the Houthi. The reality is the Houthi control most of northern Yemen, and it's better to hold direct talk with them than to live in a denial and ignore their control and presence in Yemen. Now, having direct contact with the Houthi will establish dialogue, direct talk, exchange of prisoners, halt the attacks on both sides, bring to Sana'a humanitarian support. The Saudis are desperate because the new Biden administration said it will block arm delivery to the kingdom and hold Crown Prince accountable for the Yemen war and all the murders that he did, and in particularly the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi 2 years ago in Istanbul. Even if the new administration doesn't hold Mohammed bin Salman to account, it is likely that there will be a cooperation in the Congress. So designing the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it is definitely going to make it extremely difficult, that already difficult situation on the ground. It will neutralize the effort of humanitarian relief organization to get food and medicine to millions of Yemenis.
Let's continue that trend of thought, Eli Joseph James, and ask you, given the fact that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was advised from months ago, and as our guest there from years ago, perhaps, if they wanted to designate the group as a terrorist organization, they may have been told this, that they're going to have a situation humanitarian-wise that's going to get exacerbated. After all, this is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But given that fact and knowledge that the Secretary of State did have, he still went ahead, or the Trump administration still went ahead with this. Do you think that? Why do you think that is? Why would they do this?
Well, let me say first that President Trump has actually been a relative peacemaker while he's been president. The Democratic Party, with Obama, escalated the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. It's Trump who's pulled out troops and has not made any new wars, which has been unusual for American presidents to not engage us in any new wars. However, given the fact that Biden and Hillary Clinton are cut from the same cloth, I would not expect any promises by Biden to be kept on behalf of Yemen and Houthi, none whatsoever. That's just propaganda he's issuing because he wants to curry favor with anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, okay? Remember, it was Hillary Clinton who orchestrated the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, and Biden has always been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, so I would not expect 1 ounce of support from Biden except rhetoric. That's all I would expect from Biden. As to why Mike Pompeo has done this, again, I think it's just posturing by people. I don't think Trump wants to get us involved in yet another conflict. And from my perspective, America has pretty much stayed out of this, except for rattling sabers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But this, from my perspective, this is Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen. So the Saudis need to be held accountable for invading a sovereign country. I don't know why they did it, but probably at the behest of the Israelis, whose basic policies in the Middle East is to disrupt every other nation except Israel. That's their basic policy. And because the Zionists have so much power here in America, whatever administration we have is pretty much going to do their will.
Okay. The conclusion, Elijah Magnier, that I'm getting from our guest there, Elijah Joseph James, is that the U.S. under President Donald Trump did not engage in a war during his 4 years, and Israel is the one that is interfering or that is somewhat having a hand in all the countries in West Asia, as we call it, or the Middle East. My question would be then, does the U.S. subscribe to provide military equipment via arms sales to countries like Saudi Arabia? Does that make it exempt from not participating in a war like in this case, Yemen, in which, by some accounts, hundreds of thousands have died?
I tend to agree with the half of the answer. So, yes, Israel acted as an advisor to Trump in giving it the Syrian Golan Heights, the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Jerusalem, and Pompeo gave the settlement to Israel. But I fully disagree with your guest when saying Trump did not start a war. Indeed, he has started many wars, because war is not only military, it's also about sanctions. And he starved people in Venezuela, he starved people in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that is another soft war that is more harmful than a military war. And we saw the war on Iraq, how the Americans defeated Saddam Hussein, but then they couldn't win the war. So they found another way to allow ISIS to occupy the country. So no, Trump also killed General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. So yes, he made assassinations, and he pushed the whole Middle East to the verge of a very general war that he could start it but not end. On the other hand, in relation to Yemen, the U.S. sold weapons to Saudi Arabia to continue the war on Yemen, and that is a very direct participation to the war crime that the Saudis are committing with U.S. weapons and German and French and the U.K. So there are many participants to this war on Yemen, not directly with many troops on the ground, but there are definitely some U.S. troops guiding the Saudis and offering intelligence, and that is a war that have participated. So it is not right to say the U.S. is not participating to the war on Yemen. It is directly participating to the war, and Trump is responsible for the starvation that's a soft war on many other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Joseph James, I mean, we can't just skim over. I mean, when I asked you the question, you immediately went and talked about how under Obama, so forth and so on, and Biden is a supporter of Clinton. My question to you was about the humanitarian aspect. We can't skip over this. We're looking at the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This move puts humanitarian access at risk. There are people who are not only dying from now COVID-19, they're dying of starvation, famine, all different sorts of diseases. At the same time, what our guest there from Brussels said, it risks future peace talks between the Ansarullah and the opposition. Does the U.S. then want to sabotage, perhaps, any chance of peace by making this type of announcement?
Well, first let me say I can't argue with anything that Elijah just said in terms of boycotts, because, yes, indeed, boycotts are a form of war, right? I was just referring to a military invasion. But, yes, the United States government has been in bed with the Israelis since the Six-Day War. And, in fact, the Israelis attacked one of our ships, the USS Liberty, and that's been downplayed and even totally suppressed. You know, so the Israelis make war on everybody. They make war on everybody. But it's Rothschild banks that run the show in virtually every country in the world, except possibly Iran. I'm not sure if there's any other country that has been resisting the will of the Israeli state and the Zionists who control the world economy. They control the world economy. So if any American president or leader contradicts the will of these Zionists, he's the first one going to be assassinated, as President Kennedy found out. So you can't blame this on the Americans. You have to look at the source. And I think, in spite of all that, Trump has been a less aggressive president than anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you and Elijah is expect Biden to be far worse than Trump.
So this leaves us now in a situation where, as you said, Elijah, the Biden administration, I mean, this thing is going to go into effect possibly the 19th of January, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. So it's going to leave, kind of pass on the baton to him. What type of approach may we expect from Biden? Will he be proactive, as the news now indicates, for example, today, where key U.S. lawmakers actually urged a quick reversal of this? And I'm going to quote, "The designation of the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is a death sentence for thousands of Yemenis," coming from Senator Chris Murphy.
Unfortunately, we can no longer trust what the president or president-elect or president candidates are saying. We saw what Obama said before the elections, and we saw what Trump said before the elections, and now we hear what Biden is saying prior to the election. So there are many talks today within the U.S. administration, and many talks of the presidential candidates, that they change their mind once they are in power. And we see Biden's may have priorities like China, like Russia, like the nuclear deal with Iran, and perhaps Yemen is not on top of his list, as well as the withdrawing from Iraq or from Syria, or leaving Lebanon alone to sort out its own problem. So basically, we can't really trust what Biden is going to do, and we don't have to give a lot of weight to what he said against the Saudis and that he's going to stop the war in Yemen. Definitely, we can come out with the conclusion that Pompeo is doing everything he can to put pressure and to slow down any process the new Biden administration may have think to do in the future to remove all these sanctions. Because, I mean, the guy is not stopping. Every single day in the last 20 days, he's coming out with a new sanction. So what Biden is going to do is really unclear, and how much time he needs to undo all these obstacles that the Pompeo is putting in front of him, or perhaps benefit from these already imposed sanctions and are in place to say, hey, I didn't do it, that's Trump, and I need time to undo everything. So personally speaking, I cannot trust the Biden administration and say this guy is going to come and make changes. He had the domestic first, he had the relationship with the allies that are spoiled, and then he has China, Russia, etc. So no, I don't think the war on Yemen, the criminal and devastating war on Yemen, is going to stop in one day or in one month even.
Well, let's try to figure out, Eli Joseph James, what this war is all about. I mean, maybe you can tell us. Do you know what this war is all about?
Well, yes. I'm not sure. Oh, all I know is that the Saudis invaded Yemen, right? Not the other way around. And as you said at the very beginning, it's the victims who are being blamed for the crisis, when the crisis, when the big bully in the Middle East there is Saudi Arabia. They're the big bully. And as I have stated many times here at Press TV, the Saudis are puppets of the Israelis, and they do the will of the Israelis without question. So, and they're using the Saudis to destabilize the rest of the countries in the Middle East. That's what they're doing, especially Iran. We know what they did to Iraq, but they've pitted Iraq against Iran in the war and elevated Saddam Hussein. Then they stabbed him in the back and made war against him. Now, this is the only kind of activity you can expect And unfortunately, our government is so weak vis-a-vis the Zionist power. And of course, from the UN, because the UN is just another paper tiger in terms of how they approach these issues. Yeah, okay, so they may condemn the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, but what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything, because the Rothschilds created the UN, the Rothschilds created the Israeli state, and really what needs to happen is the other Middle East countries, when there used to be an oil cartel, or we called an oil cartel, of people against the Rothschild money power, they need to reorganize against that same power and put pressure on them somehow. I don't think that they can organize a war against Iran, although they've been threatening that for the longest time. But the other Arab country, Arab and other countries in the Middle East need to join against this power called the Israeli state. None of this is going to stop until we do that.
Okay, my final question then goes to you. In Brussels, Elijah Magnier, there are some who have said that if this war was to stop, it could be done with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. Do you think that that is the case, that the U.S. could actually stop this war with one phone call to Saudi Arabia?
I think so, yes, because the Trump revealed many realities during his administration. He said to the Saudis, you will not last for 1 week without my protection. And he said, if you stay for 2 weeks, you will start speaking Farsi. Therefore, when the Americans put pressure on the Saudis to reconcile with Qatar, that was done from one day to another. And Saudi Arabia is just a kingdom that is imposing itself on the Saudis population, because it had the Americans behind it, supporting it. And the Americans, obviously what Trump said, because he said many truths, he doesn't want to lose them. He doesn't want to lose their money. So the day the Americans decide to stop this war, I don't think it will require more than 24 hours. But the Americans are benefiting from this war. As long as it lasts and continues, so are the Europeans. So there are many people benefiting from the misery of the Yemeni and the famine that they are going through, and the killing of over 45,000 Yemeni in the useless 6 years of war, just because Yemen and Sana'a decided in 2015 that there will be direct flight between Sana'a and Tehran, and that the Iranians have access to the port of Hodeidah. That's it. The Yemenis are not allowed to have relationship with Iran and decide their faith, and they have to remain as servants to the backyard of the Saudis.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, radio host and political commentator, Eli Joseph James from Chicago, and journalist and political analyst, Elijah Magnier. Thank you. Spoke to us from Brussels. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitakwe and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from a series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio, and our discussion concerning the doubts or misconceptions on this very important topic. For this cause, we have invited Islamic researcher Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, on the continuation of our discussion from previous session, we have been talking about the doubt or misconception on Shi'ism on the topic of Mahdawiya, or the concept of Mahdism, there was a doubt posed by a Wahhabi scholar saying that at the time of the birth of Imam Zaman, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, even the Shias were denying the birth of Imam and referring to a hadith to Nobakhti, and it was discussed to some extent in our previous session. Now we want you to shed some more light on it, Sheikh, because it is quite famous among Shias that there is no other sect in Shiism. Even those who believe in Imam Radha, it means that they are not from Waqafiyya and any other sect that was famous to be among the Shias or the Shia communities. So for all of the Shias living today, Dwellers, it's quite clear that the birth of Imam was accepted and verified and propagated by the contemporary scholars. So what is this doubt? What is the root of this doubt, and what does it want to cut from this belief?
As I mentioned in the previous program, this Wahhabi author, he has referred and he has found one sentence in the book Firaq al-Shia by Nobakhti, who is one of the Shia scholars, referring to this claim that the Shia after Imam al-Askari alayhi salam were divided into 14 sects and groups. And he claims that this shows that only one group believed in Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam as the 12th Imam, and the remaining 13 groups, they did not believe in him as the 12th Imam.
True.
We said that, first of all, as you rightly mentioned, the, almost all the Shia scholars agree that whoever believes in Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam believes in 12 Imams. We do not have any division after Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam and after Waqifiyya. And second of all, this Wahhabi scholar, he wants to deny the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. When it comes to the Shia books and Shia scholars, we have many narrations in this regard. And this is an important discussion, because nowadays many people, they talk about historical Mahdi and non-historical Mahdi. Like, we have it the same among the Christians, whether Jesus was historical or not. Did we have a person called Jesus in the history or not? I mean, they want to say that whether we are able to prove the existence of a person called Jesus in the history based on the historical evidences.
Yeah.
The same has been mentioned regarding Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
True.
Now, one important point regarding Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is that some of the Sunni scholars, they have accepted and they have confirmed that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam had a son, and this is the son that the Shia believe to be the promised Mahdi. So the confession of these Sunni scholars are very important for us. They are great scholars in hadith and history, and they prove the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and that is enough for us to prove, even for Sunni brothers, that our 12th Imam, who is Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, was born. And the claim that the claim of this Wahhabi scholar that there was no child for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam is wrong.
Now, Sheikh, isn't it better to see what was the reason that Nobakhti, as a Shia scholar, claimed such a thing in his book? That is there any evidence to tell us that what was the supporting idea of the sentence to be seen in Nobakhti's work?
You know, the book Firaq al-Shia, these books which talk about different denominations, mm-hmm. they try to mention any denomination. I mean, our definition of a firqa, of a sect, might be different from that of Nobakhti. So, for example, today we have the Ethna Ashari Shia. Now, maybe, just to, I mean, for the sake of argument, in Bahrain, a person claimed that I am a 12er Shia, and I am the promised Mahdi, or I am the 13th Imam, and 10 people follow him. Do we call it a sect, a firqa, or denomination?
Definitely no.
Definitely no. But when it comes to an author of a book regarding the denominations of the Shia, I believe that maybe this is the reason. Because it has happened after Imam al-Askal al-Islam that few Shia were very few in number. They did not believe in Imam al-Mahdi al-Islam. You have the cases like Shalmaghani and some few deviated people. So maybe Nobakhti has taken into consideration the beliefs of these few people, which in our terminology cannot make a denomination. And that is why I mentioned that even if we accept this claim of 14 denominations, we believe that the great majority were the 12 were. And that is confirmed by almost all the Shia scholars. So maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe what he means is those sects who were founded by one person and maybe followed only by him and no one else. Mm-hmm. And in because
has he introduced any of those 14 categories that he's
as far as I know, no. I mean, this scholar also does not refer to any name.
Very
he
true.
Just mentions the number. So regarding the Sunni scholars, Ibn Hazm, the famous Sunni scholar in the 6th century after Hijra, in his book Al-Fasl fi al-Milal, he says that Rawafid, meaning the Shia, they believe that imamate is only in the children of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, of course, he says that when Hassan, referring to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, passed away, the majority of the Shia, they believed that he had a child and he was hidden. And also, Ibn Hazm says that the great majority of the Shia, they believed that Hassan ibn Ali, that is Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, had a child, his name was Muhammad, and this Muhammad ibn Hassan is alive. And he will not die before uprising, and he will fill the earth with justice. So he himself does not believe in him as the promised Mahdi, but he proved that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was born to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. And the claim of this Wahhabi scholar that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam did not have a child is wrong.
Wherever you be, you're the one, my heart is to meet you.
The other Sunni scholar is the famous scholar Al-Ash'ari. He wrote a book in the year 297, which means that it was about 37 years after Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. So it is very important. This book was written in the time of the minor occultation. It's of a great significance for us in our discussion. A book which is written few years
contemporary after, to the time.
Yeah. Few years after the martyrdom of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. He says that, again, he says that the great majority of the Shia, they think and they claim that the Holy Prophet chose Ali ibn Abi Talib as the first Imam. Then he mentions the other Imam, and he comes to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and then he says, and they believe in the imamate of the son of Askari, whose name is Muhammad, and they believe that he is the awaited Mahdi who is in occultation, and he will reappear and fill the earth with justice. So we see that even these Sunni scholars, they also believe and confirm the fact that a son was born to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam.
Shaykhna, it is also being said by some doubts that can be seen and read here and there, that the Shias, contemporary to the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they were in doubt who is the right successor of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. And with the famous story of Ja'far al-Kadhab, to some extent it can be digested and accepted that, yes, there was sort of ambiguity for some, but the way very, I think, right after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hasan al-Askari, in a short time, it was quite clear for the followers of Imam who is going to be the successor. let's say, the right successor of the Imam. So how can we study that time and era to see if there was any, let's say, ambiguity for the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt or those who wanted to see who is their Imam and portray a good picture of that time, please, for us?
If we go back to the history, we know that how Musa alayhi salam, Prophet Musa alayhi salam was born. Pharaoh was looking for the newborn children to kill them. And let's compare it to the birth of our Prophet. So if at the time of Prophet Musa alayhi salam, if we ask the people, did you see a person called Musa alayhi salam is born to such and such family? Of course, most of the people would deny that because they did not see that Musa alayhi salam was born, privately. But when we ask the people in Mecca about the birth of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, all of them agree that. So I think the case of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam among the Shia imams is an exception. And history tells us that even the Abbasid caliphs, they knew about the birth of a child to Imam al-Askari alayhi salam who will finish their all the oppression.
Very true.
And also we know that the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was a miracle, as his mother did not show any sign of pregnancy before the night of his birth. So it is natural that when we compare Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam to other imams, the number of the people who saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam was less than the number of the people who saw the previous imam. And this is very natural.
And it can be referred to the story of Musa, that even no one witnessed the birth of Musa alayhi salam.
Yeah, that was the similarity between Musa alayhi salam and Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So when we talk about the fact that the number of the Shia who saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is less than the other imams, this is because of the situation. This is the promised Mahdi, and his life is in danger. And even his birth is through a miracle, and only few people were able to see him. So it is, again, natural for some Shia to have some doubts.
Very true.
We are not negating that. But the point is that, first of all, according to explicit narrations, some of the Shia saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. Imam al-Askari alayhi salam introduced Imam Mahdi as the next Imam after him to some of the close companions to him. We have enough evidences in the narrations to prove that. But at the end of the day, it is natural for some Shia who did not see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam to have some doubt. Yeah. But these doubts were gradually removed by the Shia scholars who wrote some books about the concept of ghiba of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, which inshallah I will explain in the following session.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, for your scholarly answers to the question, and you, respected listener, for staying tuned and listening to our discussion concerning the doubts on the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the, let's say, misconceptions that goes around this topic, and they were answered. And it was said that no Shia scholar claims that Imam was not born at the time of Imam al-Hasan al-Askari, and also except there is a single writer who claimed this, and it was also an excuse for some to resort to in order to say that Shias were in doubt to see who is going to be the successor of the Imam, and he wants to go to this conclusion that the Imam was not yet born. So there are lots of evidences that shows that Imam was born, definitely, and all of the scholars of the Shia in the course of history, not only today, believe that the Imam has been born at that time from Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam, and he is alive. And in case there is a person claiming such and such, cannot be defended and cannot be referred to. Thank you very much again, and inshallah we shall continue our discussion in upcoming sessions. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Allahumma.
the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjab bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hudaydah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
الحديدة هي لها نصيب الأسد من هذا الجانب.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's Navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's Navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the marked danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine, and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean, the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zanganeh says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zanganeh says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%. But the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow-Baku deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the US. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agreed to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Hankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Марина Картунова, Москва.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump's supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
2021 will not be any better than the previous years for the health sector in Yemen. This was confirmed by Health Minister Taha al-Mutawakkil in a press conference in the capital Sana'a in response to questions